Good morning. This is Seth with SethPerlow.com and TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit for Parents. I'm super excited to be here today with Dr. William Stixrud and Ned Johnson, authors of the book, The Self-Driven Child. And I'm super excited selfishly because Debbie Reber recommended their book to me a while back, and I listened to it on audio, and the whole time I'm going, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's what I do. Yeah. There's so much overlap, and we frame things differently, but I'm just really excited because they articulate things extremely well, parents. So I'm really excited for you to be able to get some concepts today that are going to be so, so, so helpful to you. So good morning, guys.
Morning, Seth.
Morning. Let's do a little bit of personal background. Who are you guys outside of work? Is there an outside of work?
Yeah, well, for me, I spend almost a couple of hours a day meditating. I'm into yoga, and I play in a rock and roll band, and I have two kids and three grandchildren. It's been a lot of time.
Awesome.
I have a sophomore daughter and a rising senior son who's going through all the test prep stuff with me right now, which is why we had a kind of a perhaps unique experience of taking the SAT together last year. Tweeted that out as a hashtag worst father son outing ever. I got great kids. I'm also a transcendental meditator, but I spend a little more time playing with a tractor and a chainsaw to Bill's playing in a rock and roll band.
Right on. Awesome. And then as far as professional background, what do you guys want us to know?
Well, I make a living for the last 35 years. I made a living by testing kids. And I primarily see children, teenagers, and young adults who have learning disabilities or questions about ADHD or emotional problems, autism. And I just test them and try to figure out what's working, what's not working well, and how to help.
And I've spent, since 1993, about a little over 40,000 hours one-on-one doing test prep, you know, through the whole alphabet of standardized tests, in addition to, goofing around with all the content that's in there. What I found is that the things that are in our book end up being just as significant, if not more significant, in kids doing their best when they're under pressure. So all the things that we hope to talk about today with you.
Awesome. Cool. And the book is The Self-Driven Child. And we had somebody on talking about self-reg. A lot of people talk about, there we go. What's the subtitle there?
The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives.
So I'm excited to dive into this. This has everything to do with executive function. And I really like the angle that you guys take on the book and how you guys chose to approach communicating these ideas. So as we dive into it, can we start with a definition of executive function from your perspectives, and then how that is related to what a self-driven child is?
Well, I'll say that, I've been lecturing and writing about executive functioning since the late 80s, and I thought a lot about it, and I think that I think the easiest way to think about it, it's the kind of mental processes that are necessary for anything that's goal-directed, anything that's purposeful. Anything that you can't do just reflexively or automatically, anything that is required to involve in the pursuit of goals is really what the executive functions do. And the relationship to our book, the main point of our book is that a sense of control, a healthy sense of control over your own life, doesn't mean I get to control everything or I get to be the boss or I'm supposed to control everything. Just having a sense I'm not helpless, I'm not hopeless, I'm not passive, I'm not overwhelmed. Just having a healthy sense of control is good for everything. And increasingly, kids are experiencing less and less control over their lives. And we know that there's a brain state that fosters this healthy sense of control, and it's also the optimal brain state for promoting healthy executive function.
Awesome, thanks. And would you agree, would you say it the same way, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose that the only sort of piece that I would add on to that is, that when I talk with kids about this, I'm always looking at this from again with the work that I do, a kind of performance perspective, and the idea that anything that promotes executive functions, you're simply going to think that, oh, I'll put it this way, that it doesn't matter so much what I help kids put in their own, if they put in their brains in terms of knowledge and skills, if under too much pressure, you know, they kind of lose their minds. And so this idea that executive functions are extremely vulnerable to stress, to sleep deprivation, you know, to all these, there's so many things that can impact your executive functions. And a lot of times when people underperform, they think it might have to do with their knowledge or their, you know, or how smart they are, when really it can, that prefrontal cortex is so stressed, is so sensitive, that when we look at underperformance, we want to be thinking about this from what supports people being able to think most clearly and do their best work. And so again, you know, those executive functions are so sensitive and so vulnerable, and we really want to pay attention to the inputs and what makes it easy for kids to do their best work.
So you guys have spent a lot of time together, and you guys connected. You said, let's take on this massive project of a book together to communicate some of our ideas that we're most passionate about. And one of the things I really like a lot about you guys is you are super heart-centered, and that's very evident to me in your work. How did you guys sort of come together and say, this matters to us? Let's spend, I have no idea how much time to figure out our ideas. And then how did you guys land upon and agree upon your title? Why are those words so, why were those so important to you?
So Ned and I became friends. We don't remember quite when, but we've been lecturing together. We started lecturing together probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And I'm lecturing about the development of self-motivation and about stress, about the effects of stress on performance and executive functioning and mental health. And at one point, probably 4 years ago, we decided, let's write a book about the stuff that we know is really helpful to people. And we're talking about what should be the organizing concept of our book. And Ned at one point said, you know, I think that everything that we think is helpful is related to a sense of control. And you know, we knew that a low sense of control is the most stressful thing in the universe. And so we figured that if we have this epidemic of mental health problems in children and teenagers and young adults now, and these are stress-related problems, depression, anxiety, all that stuff. And if a low sense of control is hugely related to stress and to stress-related problems, it must be a really big deal. And also, we knew every place we looked to understand how do kids become self-motivated, all the arrows pointed in the direction of autonomy. They have to have a sense that this is my life. I'm going to get out of what I put into it. And so we focused on that. Actually, the initial title when we sent our book to our agent was, It's My Life. We like this question, whose life is it? And for our point of view, it's largely the kid. It's the kid's life. And then the title, The Self-Driven Child, was suggested to us by our publishing company, and it fit pretty good.
Yeah, and so much of the... Edward Deci and Richard Ryan, who self-determination, there is a big focus in our book, make the distinction between autonomous motivation of I'm doing this because I want to, versus for carrots and sticks, or rewards and punishment. And he makes the point that it's not the sum total of motivation that matters. The character, the nature of the motivation is really a big deal. And so there are way too many kids who are performing, even if they're performing at a super high level, they're doing it because they're constantly under stress or someone's constantly on top of them to do this and do this and do this and do this. And so, you know, when you have kids in that sense who are driven, but, you know, you can sit there and drive a herd of cattle too. And that's a very different experience. We don't want that for our kids, because otherwise, if they're for them to continue moving forward, there has to be someone else who's always driving them. And we just, it's so much more enjoyable for me to feel like, for Bill, for Seth, for anyone in the audience listening, to feel like I'm driving myself forward. I'm pursuing things because they're meaningful to me. And so, you know, there are many, many books, of course, and some of them wonderful that have been written about how do you support kids, how do you help them be successful. But for us, it was super important that the energy of this be about how do we help kids want to do this themselves rather than giving parents a bunch of tools to sort of drive their children, because it's terrible for children. Lousy as parents, like, I don't want to be on top of my kid. I want to be dad. I want to be there to help. We talk about in the book, I want to be a consultant, but I don't want to act like it's my job to make him be successful. It's my job to help him be as successful as he wants to be.
But one of the problems that I think a lot of parents I don't even know where to go, because I could go in so many directions. I guess let me go here. You two both seem to work with different sort of poles of motivation. Ned, you seem to work with people who are almost, if there was such a thing, over-motivated.
Yep, and peeling off the wall.
And Bill, you sort of work with ones who are not motivated, and that's more what I work with, is students who are failing. So you're one, am I correct in understanding, Ned, you spend a lot of time with the perfectionistic side? And
well, I do, but I also, you know, Bill makes a great point, you know, that if you have any family that has three kids, the chance that there isn't at least one kid who struggles with motivation or anxiety, it's pretty low. So I certainly work with as much as I work with highly gifted or highly driven students, I probably work more with highly gifted or highly driven parents, right? You know, the children of which some of them are really perfectionistic, but I also work with a lot of kids who are like, you know, the parents both went to Harvard and their older sister went to Princeton. And it's a kid who has different intellectual bent, different intellectual gifts. So I certainly get my fair share of kids who are really struggling. And a big part of that is then for me, how do I find a way to lower the stress for them? How do I find a way to help them be motivated? Well, we put this in the book that the current model for a lot of schools, or the message to a lot of school population, seems to be, if you're not top 10%, you're never going to be successful in life, which is, of course, rubbish, but two, is unbelievably unmotivating and demotivating to the other 90%. And so when I have kids who are, you know, the bottom quartile of intellectual gifts or academic, I have to find a way to make them want to work hard, because they have to build a life too, even if they're not going to get great scores and not going to go to elite colleges.
Yeah, we share a fair amount of clients. I just saw somebody yesterday. I finished an evaluation on a 23-year-old who did 2.5 years of test prep. Not with the most effective part was came to Ned, but just really high stress, high intensity, but also have learning disabilities. So I think we both see a lot of kids, some of the kids we're trying to peel off the wall, and some of the kids that we're really trying to help them find, kind of light that fire inside themselves.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So you mentioned the word success, and I think there, and kids at different in the top 10% or this percent or that. So I think we get very lost in ideas like that. So how do you define success?
Well, for me, it's people, if I get to reflect on what's important to me and make goals that are moving me in the direction of the kind of person that I want to be and the kind of life that I want to be. Oh, there's some, oh gosh, I'm forgetting the guy's name. He's this guru on motivation. He's from Denmark or something like this. And he had this definition, Frank Summit, or I can tell it to you later, but his definition for the meaning of life is doing work that is meaningful, that makes your help meaningful to other people. That's pretty good, right?
Absolutely.
And so for me, success is, you know, developing yourself in ways that you're pursuing goals that are meaningful to you. And in a perfect world, that includes, how do you contribute to the world? How do you contribute to other people? I mean, the test prep that I do, yeah, I help people move scores up, but more importantly, it's this opportunity to help shape kids and help them align their efforts with goals that are meaningful to them.
I think that's really good. You know, we say when we lecture, you know, that we want kids to be as successful as they want to be. And we want them to be able to enjoy their success, because we see people who have all kinds of manifestations of outward success in terms of money and prestige and successful careers who are just miserable inside and just don't enjoy any of it. And for me, when I think
that's about not success, I would say that's not success. Yeah. The outward.
It seems to me that really successful people are people who've been able to create a life that's meaningful. They feel it's meaningful and satisfying. And you see people who burn themselves out in Wall Street or come out of Ivy League schools and want to go farm in upstate New York. You know, and I think people who are happy farming in upstate New York have a successful life. And so I don't think that there's any kind of objective measure. For me, it's much more, are you creating a life? Are you living a life that's fulfilling to you and makes sense to you? And I think the service piece that you mentioned is so important. So some of the kids that we work with, you know, have never had a job. They've gone to camps. They may go to Rwanda to do something for a camp in a couple of weeks, but they don't really have the kind of emphasis on service, I think, helping other people. Yeah. I think it really helps kids feel good about themselves and understand who they want to be.
Awesome. I really wanted to dive into that a little bit, because I think that's so important in my work too. Like, one of the things that I say a lot, so for the parents who are watching, the number one thing that I've heard more than probably any other thing from parents over a 20-some year career is, all I want is for my kid to be happy and successful. Some version of that sentence. So the implication when parents say that is, I'm afraid they're not going to be. Yeah. So in my work, you know, I use the term executive function all the time, but why? To what end? And like you said earlier, is it just so that they get all these things done? No, it's so that they can create a future that's built with things that matter to them, that are meaningful, that are purposeful to them. And what you both said about service too, I think we don't talk about enough, but that's when all of us, us adults who are relatively happy, like we figured out that some of the most meaningful moments in our life is when we're serving others, when we're doing things and we're not expecting something or worried about this or that, we're really giving from here. And that's magical. We know that. So to give the kids those experiences to be successful and happy, I mean, everybody can define it differently, but I think we're all going towards the same thing. And the self-driven piece, it fits so tightly into that. And so this leads us, and it looks like you want to say something, so I want to hear that, but this also will lead us into the problem. So my question then is, so what? So if we want to be happy and successful, what's the problem? And then that I'd love to hear about some of the problems. And, you know, and if I will say one more thing that I think fits and that I heard you guys talk about on an interview was that a lot of us, I may botch this a little bit, but you'll get the idea. A lot of us as adults spend decades unlearning the messaging that we got about what we are supposed to be like, or what's supposed to matter to us, or who we're supposed to be. And we end up asking the question, what do I think? What do I really believe? So can you go in that?
Yeah. I mean, when I started my career in the mid-80s as a neuropsychologist, I used to do a lot of psychotherapy. And I used to see a lot of young adults and people in their 30s, 40s. And I saw so many young adults who were 35, 40, 29. And they'd say that I feel like I spent my whole life trying to live up to other people's expectations. Now I'm trying to figure out what's important to me. And it just seemed to me we could start a lot earlier than 35 or 40.
Yes.
And I've been asking three questions. I've been suggesting that parents ask three questions to kind of orient their thinking about their relationship with their children. One is, whose life is it? The second is whose responsibility is it? And the third is, whose problem is it? And I think that so much of our emphasis is on helping kids understand who they want to be, and developing the ability to become who they want to be. And certainly many of the kids that I work with, and certainly a lot of kids you work with, have difficulty with attention, focus, executive function, or learning that makes that process more challenging. And we address that some ideas about that in the book. But God, the main thing for us is we want to recognize this is really the kid's life. We don't always know what's best for them. And our job is to help them figure out how to make decisions, how to learn to evaluate things, how to go after it, create a life that is meaningful.
And Ned, did you want to follow up on that?
No, I think that covers it well. I think that covers it well.
So I can hear parents listening to this and saying, I hear you, but because I think it's terrifying for parents to let go of the reins. I think it's very hard for parents to know when am I doing, this is a question I hear a lot. How do I know when I'm doing too much and how do I know when I'm not doing enough? And what if I listen to you and I let go of the reins too much and everything falls apart? And then I also see the pendulum swing a lot where they're really pushing their kid and their kid's executive function. They're on top of everything. Then they get sick and tired of it and they get sick and tired of the fights and they say, fine, you do it. The pendulum swings the whole other way, way too far. They're like, you do it yourself. And then they fail every class that semester. So,
yeah, several things. I mean, the first thing, a point worth making is that for us, the most important outcome of childhood, and certainly of adolescence, is wiring the brain that a kid is going to take with him for the rest of his life.
Very now, well put.
This, knowing that, that the prefrontal cortex, as you want, is still developing, right? In stage 25 cognitively, emotionally, 30 or 32. But the most important outcome of high school, even though I'm a test prep guy, is not where to go to college. Because particularly if it's at the expense of developing, a brain that is internally, not externally, internally motivated, of a brain that can tolerate stress. And we have so many kids who they're super high performing, but the world in which they feel comfortable gets narrower and narrower and narrower. And we want brains that are resilient in the face of stress, because you need that in order to take on bigger adventures, right? If you can bounce back from getting beat up, then you're not afraid of throwing yourself into the fray, because you say, I can figure this out. And so with parents who have kids who struggle with executive functions, yeah, it can be a mess, right? And the kids will get terrible grades. But to echo Bill's point, whose problem is that? And we tell the story in the book. My son was in middle school, and my wife is exactly super academic and super organized, and executive functions out the wazoo, right? My son was she was helping him, and some assignment had not been done, not been handed in. I don't recall exactly what. And my wife turns, well, why didn't you hand it in? And he, reflexively, defensively said, because you didn't remind me. And I'm like, wait, time out, people. I'm like the guy running out in the middle of a basketball game. And it's like, first of all, pal, you don't throw your mom under the bus. You're responsible for your work in fifth grade, partly because we've done fifth grade, but this has to be your work. You don't want us on top of you. And to my wife, I can understand, you can understand why he says that or feels that way, because you always are there to remind him. But just because she can be on top of his life or in her life and my life doesn't mean that she should. For kids who are executive function, have struggled with executive functions, yes, they're going to make mistakes. Yes, they're going to underperform. Yes, they're going to make misassignments. Yes, they're not going to get the perfect grades. But in a perfect world, they're realizing that it's their lives, it's their responsibility. And what we suggest as parents, you don't kind of either be command and control and I'm the warden and I control everything, or like you're on your own, pal, good luck. You take this posture of being a consultant. So you're not managing your kid on top of them, because nobody, that's not fun energy to give, it's not fun energy to receive. But you simply offer help and say, is there a way I can help? Would you like me to remind you about your assignments? What can I do to help? And it puts you in a much more powerful position, and the kid in a much more powerful position. So now that you're working together rather than cross purposes. And to the question, how do you know if you're doing too much? If you feel frustrated with your kid feels it too.
When I used to do a lot of therapy in early in my career, I was struck by how many parents would say, God, I dread dinner time, because after dinner it's 3 hours of fighting about homework. And I learned in 1986, actually, for the first time, that homework doesn't contribute to learning in elementary school. And I was thinking, what's all this fighting for? If even in middle school and high school, it doesn't contribute that much. It just seems so crazy to me. Yeah. And I work with a lot of kids who are underachieving. And I ask them, if you don't turn in an assignment, who's most upset? And almost invariably, the kid would say my mom. I'd say, who's next most upset? The kid would say my dad, then my sister, then my tutor, then my teacher. And the kid was rarely on the list. And it felt to me there's something wrong with that picture. And I wrote an article in McCall's magazine in 1986 where I just suggested, just tell your kid, I love you too much to fight with you about your homework. And you start with that, then what do you do next? You say, I'm willing to do anything I can to help. I'm willing to be your homework consultant. I'm willing to work with you from 6:30, 7:30 every night. I'm willing to get a homework tutor if you need it. But I'm not willing, you're the most precious thing in the universe to me. I'm not willing to fight with you all the time or chase you around the house or act like it's my job to make you do this stuff. I couldn't make you do it. All I have to do is flop on the floor. I couldn't make you do it. So we want to change the energy, because I went to a school meeting, Seth, last school year, on an eighth grade boy who I had tested who had a language disorder and learning disabilities and ADHD, and he was in eighth grade, and they're applying out to Catholic high schools, and he was just doing terribly. And I went to a school meeting, and one of the resource teachers said it takes two resource teachers, a tutor, and the mother on the kid all the time to get him to do any work, and he was hardly doing any work. And I said, let's change the energy immediately, because if we spend 90 units of energy trying to get the kid to work, he'll spend 10. And if we get more anxious, if we go up to 95, he'll spend 5. And in my experience, Seth, it doesn't change until the energy changes. So a lot of times when first people hear us talking about this message, they say, well, you're just saying kind of back off. And that's not what we're saying at all. We're saying just don't force. Just offer to help. Offer to help in any way you can. But just don't force. And I think that one way of thinking about what am I doing too much, if it feels like you're forcing, if it feels like you're trying to make your kid do something, remind yourself you really can't make it. I mean, all you have to do, as I said, is just flop on the floor or close his eyes, and you aren't going to be able to make it. So that's my sense. Is we want parents to be as involved with their kids in a positive way, not fighting all the time, and have a really healthy, supportive relationship. And certainly, I'm the father of a kid with ADHD, and he needed more support and help. But I just said, let me, I'll help in any way. But I never chased him around the house to try to get him to work. I just offered advice rather than trying to force it on him. It just works.
You know, and if you know Adele Diamond, who's a guru on executive functions, and she has this lovely line in, I think, a TEDx talk, where something to the effect of, if you're sad or lonely, tired, stressed, or poor physical health, that executive functions will be impacted first and impacted most. And so exactly what Bill is describing is as a parent, I'm forcing the kid, I'm really goofing up my relationship with him and likely stressing him out, which sends what might be kind of not so solid executive functions, what Lily has, are getting kicked straight to the curb because I'm stressing him out and you know, his amygdala is now in charge rather than his prefrontal cortex. And if your prefrontal cortex is not in charge, then there are no executive functions, you know, in place at all. So, you know, so again, you know, really feeling the energy. I mean, one thing that's important for me as well is that, you know, kids, our adolescents are so emotionally attuned. They're not always great at understanding why. And so we talked in the book about I have a daughter who I describe as being really sensitive to secondhand stress. And so for a lot of kids, you know, where school is hard, school is stressful a lot of the time. And if they then come home and have parents who are stressed about school as well, where does the kid ever get a break? And we want home to be a safe base. And we want parents as much as they can to really move in the direction of being a non-anxious presence, because they're just like their stress will make their kids stressed, their calm will make it more likely that a kid stays calm himself and puts things in perspective and allows those executive functions to flourish and to develop, you know, by working and ideally working collaboratively, that was hard for me to say, with mom or dad's help.
And both of you use the word being your kid's consultant, right?
Yep.
And I call myself a coach. Somebody else did a talk called Parenting Like a Coach. And then somebody else was talking about being an investigator with your child. And somebody else was talking about being a detective with your child. And what all these things have to do with is the energy of the relationship or the nature of the relationship. And there seems to be this very common energy of a relationship where it's very top down. The parents are like, do this, get this done, blah, blah, blah. And then there are battles. And I know that you guys say what I say and what most of the speakers say in some way or shape or form, but is that relationship's the most important thing you got. And
particularly because long-term, I mean, I love that idea of being a coach. I mean, if you think about really great coaches, really good, you know, basketball coach like Phil Jackson, right, with all of his zen, would sit there and watch, right, and he wouldn't jump up and down about every botched play or every bad call or whatever. You know, he would sit there, you know, or Greg Popovich, right? They do their best to sit there and be as calm as they can most of the time. And they don't yell at they're respectful to their players. Yes, there are going to be conversations. Yes, you need to do more of this or less of that. But they have to be thinking not just about this play and this game or even the season, but the long-term relationship that they have with these players, because they're trying to develop these beautiful relationships of chemistry with their players and as the team as a whole. And so if the parent equivalent, if you're yelling, you know, screaming about a paper that's due tomorrow, a homework assignment, or a quiz that was a lousy grade, awesome. Maybe that'll affect the behavior for today, but you're mortgaging the future. And there's a lot more importance to the whole future relationship with your kid than the quiz that's due tomorrow.
This idea that I love you too much to fight with your homework, I'm just saying that you're much more important to me than your homework is. Yeah. And just parenthetically, about a couple months after our book came out, one of my clients was reading it, sent me an email and said, I just told my 8th grade son, I love you too much to fight with you about your homework. At first he smiled, and then he hugged me, and they said, is something wrong with you, Mom? So apparently they've been doing more fighting about homework. But I want to just add another thought, going back to your question, Seth, about when do we know we're doing too much? And another way of thinking about it is that many years ago, one of my friends, who's also a neuropsychologist, did some training on a certain kind of psychotherapy. And the therapists were told, don't work harder to help your clients solve their problems than they do. Because you're going to weaken them. Because they're going to end up thinking that the source of the solutions, the problems are within you and not within them. And I've trained hundreds of tutors to work with kids with ADHD, learning disabilities, other kinds of executive functioning problems. And I always tell them, don't work harder than the kid does. And if it feels like you're working harder, then say, look, something's wrong with this picture. Because I feel like I'm working harder to help you get better at this than you are. And if I do that, I'm going to weaken you. I love you too much to weaken you. I care too much about you to weaken you.
Yeah. And I think in order for us to be able to empower kids to take the emotional risks, which I talk a lot about this, what we're asking them to do, what I'm asking them to do as an executive function coach is do stuff they don't feel like doing. So they have to take an emotional risk in order for them to trust me enough to take steps forward and move forward with these actions that are in their own best interest. That's a risk, and there has to be the relationship there. So as you people who are coming to your book or your work, they're basically going through a transition where they have one type of relationship with their kid. I don't know if you would call it parent driven or externally driven or what, but we're moving towards this sort of self-driven dynamic. That shift, I'd imagine that a lot of parents come up against the same, a lot of parents probably come up against some of the same blocks, like you hear the same things all the time. What are some of those big blocks in that transition? Because again, I think it's scary to make that shift.
Because part of it is, you know, we know that both from a motivational perspective and a stress perspective, that a low sense of control is really, really tough. And so when we're talking about allowing children to run their lives as much as they can, again, with our support, in some ways, it's a little bit of a zero-sum game. That I'm moving, you know, my sense of responsibility, my being in control, over to my child, right, and so that he can be more driven and feel less stressed. But we know then that if I have less control, it's likely to be stressful to me. And so this is one of the things that's so hard for parents is giving their kids more autonomy means that they're in charge less than themselves. And that's just something that I think it's really important to be honest about that. so that, you know, because parents start to get, and stress makes them crazy making. And to acknowledge, of course you're stressed about this. Of course this is hard because you're now allowing your kid. I mean, think about my son just learned to drive. Think about the experience when you were a passenger, when your kid is driving the car rather than you're driving your kid with the passenger. You've basically moved 3 feet to the right, but the change in perspective is 1,000% different, right? And we're doing that, you know, kind of in all these facets of their life. And so we want to be honest with ourselves about that. We want honest with parents that we talked about that. To acknowledge that, and then there's a whole chapter in the book about being a non-anxious presence and how much that can help your kid. And in part because it's much easier for me to grant autonomy, to happily yield autonomy to my kid if I'm less anxious, I'll be much less controlling if I'm less stressed myself.
Yeah. I think that it is true that so much, we almost never get pushback in terms of these are terrible ideas. You know, it's just that it's hard to do. You know, I got a call from my wife who manages my life got a call from a woman who said, my kid had been diagnosed with ADHD, he was in first grade. He's in eighth grade now at a Catholic school. They're applying out to Catholic high schools and he won't take his medication. He's never been willing to take it. We had a meeting a year ago with his pediatrician. Pediatrician tried to have a come to Jesus meeting with him and really get him to do it. The kid refused and says, could Dr. Stitchwood talk my kid into taking his medication? And my wife said, he doesn't believe in doing that, but we will talk with your son about it. So I met with the kid and the first thing I said was, I don't want anybody to try to make you take the medication. And in fact, if people try to make you, all you can do is you put a pill in your cheek and you just pretend to swallow it and you spit it out later. I don't want anybody to try to force you because you're a smart enough kid to figure out what's good for you and what's not. However, I think it'd be in your best interest to make an informed decision, meaning to try it and just see, because if it helps you, or if it doesn't help you, you don't take it. If there's terrible side effects, you don't take it. If it helps you 10%, it's not worth it. But if it really helps you with minimal side effects, you could decide to take it or not. And so a couple of days later, the kid says, okay, I want to try the medication. He tried it, and I just tested him a couple, 6 weeks ago. It was life-changing. It just started in January. It was completely life-changing the last 6 months. But it's almost predictable, Seth, in my experience, when we take force off the table. I know that I couldn't make you do this. I'm not going to try. It would take force off the table. And we focus on that relationship part that you're talking about. That's more important. And treating kids respectfully. They're almost always willing to go along with this, or at least they're willing to negotiate and find some kind of middle ground that we can live with.
You know, one point we talk about in the book is saying to kids, it's your call. I mean, you know, it should be your call whether you do this or not, or whether you take medicine. In this example, and what that does, from, you know, if you think about executive functions, what that does is it lowers the stress, this perceived pressure, right? And it quiets the amygdala and allows the prefrontal cortex to come to be online, right? And so I always joke, it's where you bring the shields down, right? Whereas if a parent is saying, you've got to do this, and I stress the kid out, shields are up, and whatever beautiful wisdom as a parent, I think I have to share is not going to permeate that shield, right? Or kids will either fight, or they'll say, completely, which means they're not hearing a word that you say. So I have a daughter who's pretty intense, and I'll say, you know, may I offer you some advice? Is it okay if we talk about this later? You know, this is going to be your call, but I'd like to share with you my perspective on this. I'm giving her more control. I'm making a lower energy approach. And then, I mean, my daughter, who's got 25 IQ points on me, will sit there and think about this. And more often than not, she comes around to my way of seeing things, because one of the executive functions, of course, is mental and emotional flexibility. And if those executive functions are online, she's able to sit there and go, on her own time and say, maybe Dad has a point. Where if I tried to shove it down her throat, not going to work.
Ned has this great cartoon. Is a guy who is his son's by the nape of the neck. He says, "Listen up, boys, and listen up good, because I'm only going to tell you this a million times."
I like that. That's so true. I was working with a family this week, and one of the things I see with a lot of families is the dad is trying to reason with or explain or rationalize or logic the kid. And I'm like, I'm sure you've told the kid this before a million times. Like, they don't need to hear this again. Like, really think about, and you can see the body language in the child. And that's one of the things that I work with families a lot also, is noticing what's going on. But when parents are in that anxious state, it's really hard for them to be attuning, to notice and say, whoa, sorry, let's connect here. So I had a sort of, I don't know if you've gotten this question before, but we live in this world where there are so many external demands put on our kids. And as I talk about, like, the what we pile on their plates is higher and higher and higher. And a lot of times it really is unreasonable and unmanageable. You know, you got a kid who goes to school for 7 hours, then the parent's like, well, if they did all their homework, they'd be doing homework for like 5 hours every night. And then you have some kids who will do that, some who avoid it altogether and stuff like that. It is what it is. And you guys and I, we work within the confines of the situation with the client that we're working with at the time. So if you could create an ideal school and you had a magic wand, you could do whatever you wanted. Is there any core concepts that you would build into that school? And the reason I think this is valuable for parents to hear is we just say, this is the way it is. These things have to be done. Your teacher's asking this. You have to sign into 17 portals. And we just accept that it's the way it is. But we've created this. So I think it's interesting for parents to kind of hear, you know, it doesn't actually have to be like this.
Well, here in Montgomery County, and this is just a week ago, I got to write a blog on it still. They've changed the curricular choices going forward. There are no longer regular classes. Everything's advanced. Or AP or IB, right. Which is
like
just,
what we got. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's silly, right? I mean, I love if you know Todd Rose's book, you know, The End of Average. And I often think about a teacher or a classroom where, you know, I could be teaching the math lesson, right? And there's a third of the kids who are like, oh my gosh, Mr. Johnson, he's so dull, he's so slow. And they're bored out of their minds because it's not enough. And there's a third of kids who are like, why is it going so fast? This is just not, and they're just overwhelmed. And maybe there's a third right down the middle, like, yeah, this is pretty good. Bill has this lovely line where he says, the ideal learning environment is where a person feels challenged without feeling threatened. And if you're not challenged enough, it's busy work, it's endless worksheets, it's a waste of life. But if you're overwhelmed, if you're threatened, no real learning, because when that stress response goes off, again, nothing happens. And so in a perfect world, school would be designed so that we could figure out a way for kids to feel challenged without feeling threatened, without feeling overwhelmed. Because again, it's nice to learn stuff. It's nice to develop skills. But the most important outcome of adolescence is wiring the brain that you're going to carry for the rest of your life. And so if you spend years of your life stressed and sleep deprived and unhappy, guess what most of your life is going to look like? Because it's not the circumstances, that's the brand that you have and how it's going to be motivated and how it's going to react to the world.
You know, and I'll just add that we say in the book that virtually, I mean, every kind of change in education since I've been in my career, I think it has been completely wrongheaded because it has, these changes are made without considering at all the human brain and what's good for brain development. But what optimizes brain functioning? You know, as we say in our book, we'd much rather, if we were teachers, we'd much rather teach a kid for 4 hours who'd slept for 8 hours than teach a kid for 8 hours who'd slept for four. I mean, and so the idea that schools are start, you know, high school start at 7:25 in the morning is beyond crazy, given what we know about the brain. Mm-hmm. The idea that anybody would do 4 hours of homework or 5 hours of homework a night, given what we know, that after an hour and a half or possibly two for high school kids, you get nothing out of it, or it gets worse because you get tired and you don't remember what you learned anyway. If we actually take seriously what we know about how the brain works and how to optimize performance, we'd do things very differently. We wouldn't be, our schools, and I don't think there's a perfect school for everybody. You were suggesting that. I mean, there's some kids, kids are different. But I think that the good schools would value rest. We talk about in the book the balance between rest and activity. The basic rhythm of life is so out of whack in favor of activity and so little rest that we focus on rest. So we aren't going to start high school at 7:25 in the morning. And we focus on the fact that how the brain works, and that you can't cram study for 4 hours, just cram 4 hours of stuff in your head. None of us can, especially when you're at night when you're tired. And so we're gonna make homework. We're gonna make it optional. We're gonna make it ungraded, and we tell kids after a couple hours, forget it. Don't work on it. Your brain's gonna be too tired. We build in play, and particularly younger kids. A lot of play in early childhood. Play is so important for the development of executive functions, the development of problem-solving skills, and emotional regulation skills. And we certainly would not be eliminating recess. We have a lot of physical activity. So the balance between they're so focused on education now is cramming more and more crap into your head. And it's just the wrong focus because your head can't take it all.
I'm so with you. I think that's what happens is we say, okay, you've got all this homework. All this homework needs to be completed. Don't get any incompletes or zeros or late work. You got to do all the things on this homework or I'm going to give it back to you and it's going to be an incomplete. Right. And we're not looking at the big picture. And it's not, I like how you said it's ungraded. Try, you know, work on it.
Well, it confuses the means for the end. Right. I mean, I remember I took AP calculus my senior year, and math was pretty easy for me. School was pretty easy for me. And my teacher was really terrific. So I had like a 97 average or something like this in my calculus class. This teacher would not give A pluses. So I had A. So I really needed 93 to keep my A. But, you know, I did well on his test. And every week he would collect the homework. You'd have to do the homework. Well, I didn't need to do the homework. I was well rested and he explained it well. And that's all that I needed. So every week he'd come around and collect our homework, which I never did. And like any healthy relationship, the basis of our relationship was that we simply lied to one another. So he would sit there and say, "Well, did you have your homework?" And I said, "Oh, I'm Mr. Dudek. I'm so sorry. You know, I was doing those extra problems for math team because I was on the math team and he was the coach." And he said, "Oh, okay, very, very, very well." And we just did this every week, and I pretended to have done homework, and he pretended to believe me. And how silly is that, right? That that there was this expectation that everyone had to, you know, get the check or the check plus, as opposed to, does it actually help my learning, right? Now in French, which I speak très mal, right? I should have had like 14 hours a day of French homework because that's the sum total of what I can say after 4 years of French. And so we really should pay attention to this. You know, that I want with homework, you know, in a perfect world, it's shorter, it's like interval training, right? All the stuff with exercise now is this high intensity interval training where there are things that are hard and kids really have to pay attention and we want them to be all in and really focused and almost in a kind of a flow state. And then they recover, as Bill said, in part because we know that learning, much like exercise, it's not the exercise that does it, it's the recovery from the exercise. Yep. It's the learning things and then having time to daydream and space out and kind of think about and play with and integrate it with stuff you've done before. Where I see so many kids who, you know, they'll say, you know, I want to take this math test. And I say, well, do you like math? Well, I'm good at math. I got A's all the way through. I said, it's not the question I asked. Are you good at math? Do you like math, rather? Because if you like math, that tells me that you've been thinking about these things and you've this is built into this and built into this. Where a lot of kids, they get an A on chapter 7, they go fantastic. As they move on to chapter 8, they throw chapter 7 over their shoulder and drip, and at the end of the day, all they know is the last chapter that they've done because there isn't enough time to learn and reflect on, to learn and daydream with it. And if you're doing 4 hours of homework straight, there's no time to think. You just have to get the homework done.
Yet we have this idea that the more we cram in, the better. It's kind of like the workout analogy. It's fantastic. Like if you were to work out for 14 hours a day, oh, you would be like Arnold and you'd be gigantic and you'd be so healthy. No, you would not be that healthy. You would feel.
If you remember that the original use of a treadmill was a method of punishment, you know, in 17th century England, right? They would put people on a mill, on the treadmill, like a horse going around on a treadmill, and they would use them to power the mill, but also the purpose of it was excruciatingly boring, and they just have to sit there and do it all day long. boy, let's do that now as the basis of our education system.
Well, it just, you know, it seems that what we have a chapter in the book called Taking a Sense of Control to School. And our policy, basically, what we suggest about homework is the formula should be inspire, don't require. Inspire kids to learn. And teachers say, here's what I think would help you to learn this material. But if you find something better, or if you're too tired, don't do it. Do something else. And I think if we actually treated kids respectfully and say, here's what I want you to master. Here's the material I want you to master. Here's the goals we're working towards. And I here's what I'd suggest. But you know, it's not going to be graded. It's not mandatory. I think that's much more in line with what we know about research on homework, on the brain and learning, on the importance of sleep for learning and retention. It's and so the idea, I mean, the beyond crazy is staying up until midnight, studying, and getting 6 hours of sleep when probably the most powerful contributor to learning and memory is sleep. And we do, I mean, I just met with a family yesterday where a kid was in eighth grade. Is an independent school, and for him to do all the homework, he would have to do it 4 hours a night. And the parents said, look, we're going to have to take him out of the school. And one of the teachers said, look, I know that the school's not willing to change the homework policy. Just tell him just not to do it. I'll have to grade him down. But big deal, it's eighth grade. Nobody cares about his grades in eighth grade. And we do a lot of that kind of consultation with families about, you know, I think one of the most useful things I've ever learned, Steph, was that kids can flunk all their high school classes. If they decide that was a bad idea and they want to get an education, they can go to a local community college and get 30 credits, which is 2 semesters. And then they can apply to almost all the colleges in the country and not have to show their high school transcript. So we always have this idea that somehow kids always have to be doing well. It's going to affect them in the future. It's just bullshit. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's we know so many people who are extremely successful, extremely happy, extremely fulfilling lives, who are not good students, who struggle with ADHD or learning disabilities. And I think we want so much of what we want to do is in our book is give kids an accurate model of reality. You know, what does it take to create a life that works? And it's not being a straight A student. It's not doing 4 hours of homework every night. And it's part of it. So much as Ned was saying earlier, it's developing a healthy brain. Mm-hmm. A brain that's not used to being tired and stressed. I mean, the crazy thing is that if you look at the mental health problems in colleges, including the most elite colleges, they're off the charts. And the people in college say, well, it's what the kids had to do to themselves to get in.
Yep.
And we know that if a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old gets depressed, and a good formula for becoming depressed is being too tired and too stressed for too long. If we become depressed, it changes the brain in a way that just makes it more likely they're going to have recurrent depression. And that's why we so focus so much on nurturing this sense of control, because the sense of control, a healthy sense of control makes you very resilient. It makes you be able to handle stressful situations. Stress doesn't bother you as much if you have a healthy sense of control. And then from a mental health point of view, we want kids to be sculpting brains that are used to being well-rested, focused, and in that mental state that supports a sense of control and supports executive functioning.
I really like the way you guys just frame this all together. The biggest challenge for me listening, I think, is probably something you guys deal with all the time, is that we know things that would work, and how do you help families navigate the situation that they're in? And sometimes you do get a teacher who, like you guys have mentioned too so far, where the teacher says, you know what, I'm going to flex for you and I'm going to make this work for the kid. But a lot of times teachers are very rigid. There's a lot of pressure on them to cover curriculum and get through the book and get through the, you know, and so I think one of the hardest things about my job is that a lot of the things that I see that the kids have to do, I'm helping them navigate a world where I can't change the world and the expectations around them. So helping them navigate the stuff where the kid says, when am I ever going to use this? Or why is this important? Or this is busy work. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, you're right. I agree with you. You know, that's very hard for me in my work and watching just again, what we pile on, and it does not support the brain development. Right. It's doing the opposite of what we're hoping.
You know, one of the challenges is when you talk about the expectations, one of the challenges, I mean, with kids who are where school isn't easy or school isn't going well, is that, you know, as parents and even as, you know, coaches or tutors or teachers, it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that a kid who's a C student is going to have a C life. Mm-hmm. And it's just not so. I mean, I got this thing just popped up on LinkedIn. I know this family, and the parent went to Syracuse University, which is a lovely place. But, you know, graduating, you know, Syracuse in the early 80s was probably pretty close to open enrollment. Okay. So I watched this person. So ended up, then became a Rhodes Scholar, which we know was serious business, right? And is now the CEO of one of the three largest law firms in the world with thousands of attorneys. And I'm like, holy smokes, right? You know, and you kind of assume, well, everyone would have gone to Harvard and blah, 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 or Princeton or whatever, whatever. And whatever that person was doing in high school, it presumably wasn't getting the world's best grades that's ever come out of that high school, because arguably person might have ended up someplace other than Syracuse in the early 1980s. And so, I mean, Bill and I both have, you know, have worked with kids who were just, you know, they were a box of loose parts. There were some of those parts were interesting, but they were not put together well in high school. And so academic performance, you know, was kind of, you know, just a kind of a mess. And you see these kids 2 or 3 or 7 years later, and all of a sudden, all this point, this piece has been put together, and you're like, holy smokes, look at you.
You know, and I'm sure, Seth, a lot of your listeners are familiar with the work of Philip Shaw at the National Institute of Mental Health. He's the guy who's been studying brain development in kids with ADHD, and has found that with ADHD, by the time they're teenagers, the prefrontal cortex is, on average, is about 3 years less mature in mm-hmm. kids with ADHD than kids without ADHD. And I think that I mean, well, we certainly suspect that that's true, and certainly that is that we've known for 30 years that the prefrontal cortex it develops massively in later adolescence and young adulthood, but this idea that simply it's you have a less mature prefrontal cortex, that what how could you possibly if you're it's 16. You got a 13-year-old prefrontal cortex. How could you possibly expect to manage the same amount of work? Right. You know, and I think for me, so much of what I'm telling kids is I want you to work hard, I want you to rest hard, meaning get enough sleep, and I want you to be patient with yourself. And just knowing about this, and certainly the implications for a lot of kids with executive functioning difficulty who have immature prefrontal cortex is be patient. And if necessary, take a gap year before you go to college. Just give yourself another year of neurological maturation. But I think that we do a lot of that, these things that schools say you can't change. Just saying that he's not going to do it. I advise many parents to go and say, he's not going to do all this homework, so where are we now? And you put, when you say he's not going to do it, this isn't working for my kid, the schools will usually, they'll kind of work with you a little bit. But I think it's being clear that we have that right. That our kids aren't obligated to do all this crazy stuff that doesn't make any sense from the developmental, that's really harmful to their development. It doesn't make sense to say they have to do it, in my point.
Yeah. Those are really good points. Yeah. I think the big problem for me comes when we bump up against it. I think for most of my middle and high schoolers, usually there's one or two teachers who just don't flex.
Yeah.
And that's just, we got to figure out how to navigate that. Well, as we sort of get to closer to the end of this, are there any big definitions or models or things that, you know, there are parents watching that are really worried about their kid? Are there any major things that you want to mention?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we again, in the book, we have a chapter about being a non-anxious presence, right? And it was based on, there's a story to tell where I was on a flight when my daughter was about a year old, and we got stuck on the tarmac for like 3 hours at O'Hare, which is nobody's idea of a good time. And as soon as it stopped, you could feel every person on the plane is like, ugh. And my daughter, who's 1 year old, who doesn't understand what the pilot has said and certainly doesn't have any place she needs to be, immediately bursts into tears because she's just responding to everyone else's stress.
She feels the nervousism.
Right. And I did a historically and epically terrible job of trying to calm her because I was so worried we were going to be that family. I'm like, there. I mean, it was just hideous. And so what did she do but cry for hours? It was terrible. Where if I had been, you know, like someone's grandma, I'm like, it's all right, sweetheart. There. I could, if I had been really calm, I would have done such a better job of helping my daughter then. And so my daughter remains a complicated young woman, and I have gotten really good, partly I've learned TM in the interim, have gotten much, much better in the face of things really not going well to handle it well. Partly because, if you put on, you can't help someone else unless you put your own oxygen mask on first, right? Now, part of the challenge is when you have children, for people who have kids who are having a hard time, and my daughter's, you know, clinically anxious and clinically depressed, she's having a hard time. And it's really hard. I have to fight against extrapolating that where she is now is where she's going to be when she's 25. And I really have to work on my own anxiety. And so I encourage any parent who's got a kid who's having a hard time, whether it's executive functions, it's anxiety, it's depression, it's, you know, all the things that unfortunately too many kids struggle with, to work hard to be a non-anxious presence. Now, maybe not everyone's gonna do the same method that I've used, but two pieces of advice I would give if it's hard to be non-anxious. Two pieces are, one, to take the long view. If you knew that the struggles your kids are having now are part of what helps them get stronger, just like, you know, exercise or, you know, weightlifting, and you feel weak, and it's painful, but over time you get stronger. If we knew that today's struggles would be the source of tomorrow's resilience, then we'd embrace it in a really different way.
That's a great frame. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, my really quick story, I mean, I had a mother who struggled with her mental health and my father's an alcoholic, and I spent 3 months in a pediatric psychiatric hospital in seventh grade. No one's idea of a great time. But honest to gosh, now I feel so confident, probably completely without regard to my education, but I feel so comfortable helping other people through difficult things because I like, look what I went through.
Right.
And I could sort of surmount that. And so all of us should feel comfortable with it. It's okay to have some scars because it's evidence of how tough we are and what we got through. And so take the long view. And the second thing is, if you struggle to be a non-anxious presence, is make it your highest priority to enjoy your kid. Because what so often happens when kids are struggling and they're underperforming, they're screwing up this, they're wrecking the car, they're getting bad grades, whatever they're doing, it's so hard for us not to be disapproving because we sure don't want to approve of those behaviors. But we really want to make an effort to embrace the kid. We may not love the behavior, but to really put as much sunshine and love on your kid as possible. Because if you go back to Adele Diamond, if you're sad, lonely, tired, stressed, those executive functions go kablooey. Mm-hmm. And so I make it every effort I can to be as silly and as warm and as affectionate and as loving as I possibly can to my really complicated 15-year-old, because the challenges that she is going through, these are her challenges. I can't be her therapist. I can't do this hard work for her, but what I can do is be loving and make and really enjoy her presence, knowing that that's what she needs. And it also improves her executive functions and therefore her ability to solve her own problems for herself.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add on to that you know, earlier, Seth, you said that you're so often parents, I just wanted to feel happy. You know, what I've noticed over the years is so often I'll be talking with parents who were really upset about a kid's problems, not doing well in some way. And one of the parents, sometimes mom, sometimes dad, will break into tears and say, I just wanted to feel good about himself. Mm-hmm. You know, and what occurred to me is that what I started saying is, after they stopped crying, I'd say, I think we can more convincingly help him feel good about himself if we aren't so worried sick. You know, that if we can get a perspective, as you were saying, kind of take a view that for all we know, the kid's life is where it's exactly where it's supposed to be. That's his art. And if we can communicate that's a really powerful thing. And I also mentioned that, you know, both Ned and I practice transcendental meditation. I know you're a meditation guy too, Seth. And I did a couple studies of middle school kids with ADHD practicing TM. And we got really beautiful results. We got nice data, behavioral improvement, and we got one study. We basically one of the markers of ADHD is lack of balance in brain waves between the beta waves and theta waves. And we got this beautiful balancing of brain waves that really facilitate optimal executive function. And also, just to say, we had this one kid who, you know, we interviewed kids after the first study. There was one kid who was wildly impulsive, said, well, before I started meditating, if somebody bumped me in the hall, I just turn around and hit him. Now that I've been meditating, though, if somebody bumps me in the hall, I stop and think, should I hit him or not?
that's what you want.
And I think both of us are interested in building more meditation into schools, in a part from a mental health point of view, but also just this basic idea that what happens when you get stressed is that the prefrontal cortex gets flooded. Stress hormones causes flooding in the prefrontal cortex of dopamine and norepinephrine, the two neurotransmitters that run it, basically. And once those levels go too high, the prefrontal cortex doesn't function. As Ned said earlier, your amygdala, basically, your fight or flight response just runs the rest of your brain. And so we see the meditation piece as being really important for helping to regulate, develop strong connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala so that you're well regulated, and just allows those executive functions to work more powerfully.
I really like that explanation too, that meditation helps is sort of open up the communication between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex more effectively. They can they can have a better dialogue together to figure out how to better respond to situations.
You know, I was just reading recently that the best neurological marker of emotional resilience is the strength of the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. Mm. We know what shows up most consistently if an adolescent or an adult is depressed or anxious is a hyperactive, overly responsive amygdala. And so much of what we're trying to do with kids is have them sleep, learn to meditate, because it calms down the amygdala and it strengthens the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, allowing the cortex to regulate the amygdala and run the rest of the brain. And that's when you experience that sense of being controlled. When the prefrontal cortex is regulating the brain, you don't feel hopeless, you don't feel helpless, you don't feel overwhelmed, you don't feel what's the point of trying.
When you guys talk about like being the non-anxious parent, is that did I say the term right?
Non-anxious presence, but parents, non-anxious coach.
To sure. Sort of tie that together in terms of like how I frame sort of the same concept, I talk about doing your own deep inner work, that one of the best things as a parent that you can do for your kid is do your own deep inner work. If you need therapy, go get a therapist. I think so many people think that it's a sign of weakness if you get therapy. No, it is not. That is not true. If you read books like Self-Driven Child or just great books to develop yourself, go to support groups, like learn to meditate, but journal. So parents doing their own deep inner work and becoming more and more grounded in solid presences is like being a non-anxious presence more and more. And like you said, with the baby in the at the airport, like when we as adults are more regulated and calm, we are better able to help our kids with anything and not activate their nervous system.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, and oftentimes kids are, if something goes poorly, they're worried about it for themselves, but they're also worried about their parents' reaction, right?
Right.
You have a parent who's depressed all the time or angry all the time. How much of your energy is going to worrying about your mom who's sick, your dad who's angry? And if you have parents
quite a bit
who are just happy, then as a kid, I don't have to worry about them. You know, I can worry about me. I don't have to worry about them.
Mm-hmm. It's a powerful thing. And I mean, we say in the book that if kids are not doing well, most of our work as parents should be on ourselves. It's really, just as you were saying, Seth, it's really kind of managing our own emotions, being able to put things in perspective, not getting too upset, not catastrophizing, not predicting the future like it's going to be a disaster, you know, 15 years from now. I know it's going to happen when you really can't predict the future. It's so that the work is really on ourselves so that we can be, however we frame it, we can be somebody who can be empathic. It doesn't mean that we don't set limits and we don't provide structure, which kids with executive problems clearly they need. But we do it in a way that's respectful. in a way that's loving, and in a way that allows kids to feel, as you like to say, that they bring problems to us rather than avoiding us. Right. When we can be calm, we can be empathic, they come to us.
I think that's a really important point that we didn't go into today, and we'll wrap up in a moment here, but just want to reiterate that because I want parents to hear what you just said, where kids will bring problems to us. When we are the anxious presence, our kids are not wanting to come to us when they have their really deepest problems that they should be coming to us for. They're going to other people, and oftentimes they're going to kids their age who have no wisdom in life and asking for advice. And
yeah, if I can tell a super quick story, about a year and a half ago, my son was invited, there was a school dance, and he got invited to, you know, the party after the dance. And so my son, like his dad, a little geeky. And so this is kind of a big thing, right? Going to the party after the dance. And he and my wife and I are out for a walk in the afternoon. And he said, "Dad, I got a question about tonight." I said, "Yeah, what's your question?" He said, "Well, about the dance." I said, "No, it's actually the party afterwards." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, what should I do if I'm at that party and people are drinking alcohol?" Now inside I'm like, I've nailed this dad thing, but I played it much cooler than that, I promise you. And I said, "Well, that's a great question. And what do you think?" And then I shared, you know,
I love that you did that you said, "What do you think?" before telling him what he should do. That's awesome.
Thank you for that. You know, and so it's exactly, as you would anticipate, you kind of do a pro con. Well, on the one hand, this, and what, you know, we ran through this different scenarios and what his options were. But the thing that I was just so pleased, because I was, you know, in some ways reflecting back on that fifth grade thing when, you know, did you hand him the homework? And I know that had I been on top of him on every aspect of his life for the intervening years, he wouldn't have brought a really, you know, vulnerable question like, you know, alcohol at a party to ask about that, because it could have been easy to say, "Alcohol at a party, you're not going to that party," and shut the whole thing down, as opposed to, you know,
what anxious dad was there.
It was such a beautiful thing, and you know, that he would trust me. Mm-hmm. The way that I trust him, it's just, it's such a wonderful thing, because, you know, a little bit like, you know, the Lifcott Haynes, you know, we're trying to build an adult, right? And I'm trying to build a relationship with my kid, not that I have one when he's 17, but for the rest of his life, when he gets married, if he has problems at work or, you know, with his relationships or whatever, I dearly hope that I will be at least one of the voices that he'll just say, "Dad, what do you think about this?" Not that he'll agree all the time, but for him to trust me enough to ask me intimate questions is such a great thing.
Awesome. That's so good. All right. I got two wrap-up questions.
Cool.
Anything you want to pop in before I get to these? It may fit in, but go ahead.
Let's see.
I'll do one quick thing. We have a whole chapter in the book about alternate routes, and it's about all these stories about people who were, you know, who went very wandering path through their education and finally successful in college, people who didn't go to college, who dropped out of college, people who didn't go to college at all, and found remarkably cool ways to build successful lives. And for us, that's really important because, you know, like you're talking about that student of yours who, you know, who was willing to be vulnerable in talking with you, we know that if kids feel that, you know, that there's a path for them, even if they're not successful academically, it takes the pressure off. It makes them have the courage to try, right? You know, I want you to try as hard as you can and do as well as you can in school, because it's how you develop yourself. But if you don't end up going to college, that there's still a way for you to be successful in life and contribute to this world. But by not having to be, it's Yale or McDonald's, it's much safer for people to really engage in things. And if they don't end up, you know, ringing the bell and being an A student, it's not a thing at all.
Yeah. I think that's great.
Awesome. Yeah, my path was not traditional. I almost failed out of high school. I failed out of college. I dropped out of a second college because I was smart enough to drop out before I failed out. And then
I flunked out of graduate school the first time I went, and I didn't mention that when I was building my career the first few years, but God, I see so many kids who feel that they didn't do well in something. My whole life was going up in smoke, you know, and I tell them I went 20 straight weeks in the top English literature PhD program in the country at Berkeley. I went 20 straight weeks and I was so anxious and insecure, I didn't turn in a single assignment.
20 weeks.
And when I work with underachievers, I say, top that, 20 weeks with nothing. I think that taking that long perspective and finding people who have also had the similar challenges and who've been able to make it. And I'll just tell you, I noticed in my own kid, he was a psychologist and a wonderful human being. But I noticed this dramatic change in his ability to express himself between 23 and 26. And I think it reflects the fact that the prefrontal cortex comes online and starts to do things. It starts to integrate things that it didn't used to do before.
Yep.
And I think that this long perspective, this slow unfolding of the prefrontal cortex, and not only does it get more mature and faster the way it functions, it gets more interrelated to the brain. So things that you're trying to do when you're 16 or 17, maybe your left temporal lobe does it. But when you're 21 or 23 or 26, your prefrontal cortex is involved, and then you can do it much more thoughtfully, much more skillfully.
Yeah.
So we want people to take a long view.
Yeah. And I was 25 when I went back to school and
there you go.
I had purpose.
There you go.
And I've been able to build a life that is very unconventional. I work for myself and do things like this and make videos on YouTube, and I love it. And I get to serve what we talked about at the beginning.
And play blues guitar.
I love blues guitar. It's one of my favorite things ever. So here's I have two wrap-up questions. The first one is, what actions can parents take within the upcoming week to implement some of your teachings? What actions would you recommend?
I would say the first thing for me, I mean, because kids with executive functioning problems commonly struggle to get stuff done. What certainly among the handful of things I'd suggest is think about this idea of saying to your kid, "I love you to fight with you. I love you too much to fight with you about your homework or your schoolwork. That I'm willing to support you in any way I can." But if the energy is mainly coming from a parent to try to get parents feeling to force it, just realize that this is not going to help in the long run. It undermines my kid's autonomy, sense of autonomy. It mixes up a sense of who's responsible for what. If I'm taking responsibility for something his, it harms my relationship. So just decide. I'm not going to fight about this stuff. It doesn't help, and it's not worth it in the long run. And then offer to help in any way you can. Or if a kid needs more help, find somebody else. But get out of that role of feeling that being the boss or the manager or the taskmaster.
And I would add to that, if you feel like you have been not doing that the right way, if you have been a manager and riding your kid all the time, and you reflect on it, think that that was a mistake. I think it's enormously powerful if you have it within you to apologize for that, because this one way that authority can maintain its legitimacy is that when authority makes mistakes, that acknowledges, yep, made a mistake here, and seeks to make amends for that, right? And you know, so I mean, I do this certainly with my wife, with my kids, with colleagues, you know, and it's because, you know, look, I've been thinking about this, and I've realized that I've been on you all the time and telling you the same thing over and over and over about your homework and just kind of giving you a hard time as though there's something wrong with your character. And I know there's nothing wrong with your character. I know that these things are hard for you. And so I apologize to the degree to which I've been on you and making you feel bad about yourself. And I pledge to you, I'm working really hard that I'm going to stop doing that. But it's not that I don't care about you being successful. And then you pivot to Bill's point. I want to think of myself from here on out as your consultant, not your manager. It will not be my responsibility for you to do this. But if you want to do this, I'm willing to say right here now, I'll do whatever I can to help you. So I would love to, if maybe this week, if you could think about this, maybe on Sunday, if we could sit down for maybe a half an hour, and if you can tell me what are the things that I can do that can be helpful to you, it's a way to sort of put the past behind and reset that energy. And again, I think really establish yourself as an authority, small a, not I'm in charge,
right,
but small a, I'm knowledgeable and I can be helpful.
And I think that's perfect. And I'd also just say, going back to what you were saying earlier, that think tonight about what keeps me from enjoying my kid, what kind of hassles or pressures, and then see, just try to work backwards. What would I need to eliminate to enjoy my kid more? Mm-hmm. And I say this in part because, you know, I did a consultation with a kid many years ago who was 21. And in high school, he was a really terrible student. He had some drug problems. And he was still struggling. He'd had some trouble in college. He's having trouble holding a job. He's still struggling. He's a really nice kid. He's still struggling at age 21. And I asked him, is there something that your parents could have done differently when you were in high school that might have helped? And he said, I think it would have helped if they were happy to see me sometimes. And what he explained was that he was just doing so terribly, his parents felt that they had to be chronically disapproving of him.
Yes.
Or else they'd be given the message that they're just continuing screwing up. You know, exactly. And I think that we want to set limits. And certainly when we say, I'm not going to fight you about your homework, it doesn't mean that I approve of your playing video games 6 hours a day. You know, we negotiate limits with kids and we say, I can't live with, you know, that's with you doing 6 hours of video games. But I do think that the second point is just thinking about what keeps me from enjoying my kid and try to work backwards to eliminate the things that just keep you from enjoying being around your own kid. Because when kids are enjoyed spontaneously, you're happy to see them, they perceive themselves as a joy-producing organism as opposed to a frustration or anxiety-producing organism.
Ah, so good, so good. I want to add to what you two just said and something that you had mentioned earlier in the talk, but to just go on the end of what you guys just said is, parents, be patient. You're not just going to make this decision that you're the consultant and it's going to happen tomorrow. Let it be messy. It's okay. It's the direction you're going. Be patient. Your kid's going to be like, really? I'm going to test you on that. They're going to pull out all the stops probably and they're not going to
be yourself just, and your kid, not just your kid, but be patient with yourself, right?
With yourself, self-compassion. Yes.
Yeah. I think, you know, this, our book is out in paperback. It's not very expensive. And every chapter there is what to do tonight. You know, we really tried to make this as practical as possible. And we're working on another book now. We're going to try to have even more stuff that's more kind of what do you do in the moment kind of with your kid. I think part of the reason we wanted to write this book is that there's a lot of people who would come to hear us lecture over and over again, and they'd say, I feel so much more calm. I feel so much more clear about my kid after I hear you talk. And then I go talk to another parent. I get all spun up again, you know, and we wrote this book in part so people could see this from a scientific point of view. It's right not to be on your kid all the time. It's right not to be worried about your kid all the time. It's right to trust your kid. But there's tons of neuroscience in this book that support that. And I just want, because otherwise, in order for us to do this, we have to feel that it's safe. Because otherwise, we feel like terrible parents if we're making decisions that are bad for our kids. So the in the book, we lay out the rationale, including the brain-related rationale, for thinking this way, so that parents can feel safe, that it actually works, it's actually the right thing for their kid.
Awesome. Thank you. And I will reiterate too, I love the book because it's very aligned, for those of you that are watching, with the way that I approach things. And it's very accessible for parents. So my last question, and I would like each of you to independently answer this one, is from your heart, straight to the heart of the parent who's watching, who's really suffering and scared right now for their kid. What's the one message you want them to leave with? What's the takeaway?
From my point of view, one of the most helpful things if we're really upset about anything is remembering that for all we know, that what's happening in my life right now is what's supposed to be happening. Because there's no evidence that somehow my kid's really struggling right now. There's no evidence that somehow he's supposed to be doing well. It's an interesting theory, but there's no evidence for it. And I think that the idea that part of what accepting kids unconditionally is accepting whatever they're going through. And that story I told earlier about what I'd say to parents, I think we more convincingly help your kid feel good about himself if we don't feel so terrible about him. And I think it's recognizing this is part of my kid's path, and I'm going to do everything I can. If he's struggling, to help him do better and help him feel better. But I think that putting it in perspective and not thinking, oh my God, this is a tragedy, things are going terribly wrong, because I don't want to commit to him. But so much of my work was trying to help kids accept themselves as they are, even if they're struggling. And that makes it easier for them to take steps to get better and better.
Mm, So good.
It's hard to top that. Can I just say the same thing? I mean, I guess what one other, you know, the, I mean, the sort of big takeaways are, you know, for me is, you know, making your kids know that you love them. I mean, we end the book. We end the book with that quote, you know, of Maya Angelou, that people will forget most of what, your kids included, most of what you do for them, right? And they'll forget most of what you say to them, right? But what gets wired into their brains is how they feel. Because that's the nature of how brains work. Things are emotionally driven, then we come up with logical constructs for them. So we're all emotional people. And we have this opportunity as parents to wire into kids' brains feelings that carry them forward in ways that are really profound. We didn't really talk about all the science of Steve Meyer and Michael Meany, but it's in the book. And from my perspective, the things that I want my children and all the other people's children with whom I work all the while, obviously we want them to feel loved, right? And we want them to feel supported, right? So that consultant, that we're helping more, not pushing. But I also want them to feel trusted, and I want them to feel capable. And if those four things are wired into them, it's really a beautiful, it's a beautiful recipe for them to move in the direction, you know, of setting and pursuing goals that are meaningful to them. Because we work on the assumption that kids want their lives to work out. Now, they may take all kinds of messy and ill-advised short-term, you know, detours, you know, off into places where they really shouldn't be. But we really work on the assumption that long-term, our kids want to be successful. And so if we can trust that, and then again, work on how we make them feel loved and supported and trusted and capable. And we do that by giving them a greater sense of control over their own lives.
That ties it together beautifully.
Thank you.
All right, Bill and Ned. Well, thank you guys so much for your time. And
you're great.
Yeah, it's great to be with such a like, at least electronically, to be with such a like-minded person.
It is. Thank you guys so much. And for you parents out there, go take some action, and we'll see you in the next one. Take care.